Good day. Today is Saturday, 21st February 2026, and let me begin this program by reminding you again to tick the like button and check your subscription to this channel. If once you've watched this video or whichever part of the video you want to watch, you decide that you like what you've heard and you wish to indicate this fact. Now, today's program is going to be mostly about Ukraine, about the situation on the front lines, where we have important and interesting developments and, by the way, predictions, about the diplomacy, if that's the right word to describe it, and about President Zelensky's ideas for a 3-year war. But before I turn to Ukraine, I'm going to quickly turn to two other topics. The first topic is the pending conflict with Iran. Now, I understand that despite US military officials having informed the president that the United States military in the Gulf is now in a position to conduct an attack on Iran, a decision has been made, or perhaps it should be more correctly said, a non-decision has been made by the president and his officials not to give the attack order. I say that because it's not as if the president or his officials have as yet cancelled the entire military operation against Iran. Now, this is not because of any change in attitude towards Iran or perspective or any new one belief in the virtue of negotiations or any of these things. It's because of a number of factors. Firstly, I have absolutely no doubt about this, increasing concern that the military struggle against Iran is going to take longer and be more difficult than the president and some of his officials had initially realized. There are reports today in Reuters, incidentally, which again speak of the United States planning a decapitation strike, seeking to murder or kill Iranian political and military leaders, of the United States planning to do something on an even bigger scale than what the Israelis tried but failed to do during the 12-day war in June of last year, and of the intention that this decapitation strike should indeed lead to regime change. But it seems that there are now concerns that this might not be fully achievable, that the governmental system in Iran might be more stable than the president and his officials assume. And going back to that article in Reuters, there are admissions there that Iran is going to hit back and hit back as hard as it can, and that it will actually do some damage, and that this will cause US casualties. And of course, I have discussed in recent programs the extensive assistance, which, according to all sorts of reports, rumours, private emails and things of this kind that I've been getting. And also, it must be said, some of open source information, the extensive help that Iran is currently getting from China and Russia. By itself, this help would not be enough to enable Iran to endure the attack which is to come, let alone to defeat the United States. But it could make the difference, and the increasing difference, if Iran is able to absorb the blow and is able itself to continue fighting. And, well, I've no doubt that this particular president and his officials are very, very nervous about the reaction from people in the United States and of the effect on the global economy and first and foremost on energy prices. If the war does escalate and continue and drag on, and if the Straits of Hormuz, as it seems the Iranians plan, are closed during its duration. So that is undoubtedly causing some degree of nervousness and stress. I spoke in my program yesterday of the increasing signs that the president himself is under extreme stress. His bizarre statements and decisions about aliens being, in my opinion, conclusive proof of this. Anyway, that is one reason. The second reason is touched on by Larry Johnson, again, in his invaluable blog, Substack site, I should say, Sonar 21, in which Larry Johnson says that two senior US officials, two senior members of the administration, have tried to make Trump understand that he risks political suicide for himself and in the midterms for the Republican Party if he presses forward with the war. And Larry Johnson doesn't say this, but of course, if the war is of long duration, if it begins to go wrong, if American servicemen start to be killed and killed in numbers, if some are even taken prisoner, well, of course, this would be a political disaster, a calamity for the president and his party. And these two members of the administration are pointing out to the president that which is already clear from opinion polls, that the American people overall are by a significant margin opposed to a military operation against Iran. This war would be unpopular from the first moment. The Iraq War of 2003 initially did have a support from a majority of polled Americans. In this case, in relation to this war, a majority of polled Americans say that they are opposed to it. And of course, the president, who partly won the election in 2024 by promising to keep the United States out of wars in the Middle East, this is the kind of thing which I do suspect is causing him to become nervous. Now, Larry Johnson makes a further point, which is that the time window for an attack might be affected by various factors, one of which is the lighting conditions at night. At the moment, we are at a time when the moon is, shall we say, hidden, which makes nighttime over Iran very dark, which is exactly what special forces and air forces prefer when they conduct attacks of this sort. For the record, at the time of the abduction of Maduro from Venezuela, a person who I am in touch with, who has considerable knowledge of special forces operations, actually pointed out to me how unusual the timing was, because the operation to abduct Maduro took place at a time when the moon was fully visible, creating a significant amount of light. Well, the moon at the moment is not visible. Iran at night is very dark, but the situation will change fairly soon, and we will not get the same kind of nighttime conditions until mid-March. And by the way, mid-March, my guess is, would be about the right moment for the Gerald Ford aircraft carrier, which is now in the Mediterranean, to take up its positions and to prepare itself for a possible attack on Iran. It is now in the Mediterranean, But I would expect, I would assume that it would take several days, more probably weeks, before that particular carrier was ready. So if the attack doesn't happen now, then more likely it will happen around mid-March. And well, that could be very interesting timing indeed, because at the end of March, President Trump is scheduled to travel to China, to Beijing, to be precise, to meet with Xi Jinping. So if there is an attack in mid-March, the president would presumably want it to be all wrapped up and over within roughly 2 weeks, so that when he went to China and faced Xi Jinping, the whole affair would be behind him and he would co hope to meet Xi Jinping with a win. Of course, if things turn out otherwise, if the attack goes wrong, I think that this president would find it impossible to go to China and face Xi Jinping at a moment of ongoing war, especially if that war appeared to be going badly. Presumably, at that point, the president and his officials would call the whole idea of the trip to China off, which in itself would be deeply humiliating. But we can see that a mid-March attack also runs into all sorts of problems and problems of time. And well, all of these factors are now in play. And of course, the other factor that is probably affecting administration decisions at the moment is that the president is also expected soon to deliver his State of the Union address. So lots of scheduling issues and nervousness, obvious nervousness about the scale of Iran's own military preparations and of the help it is receiving from its great power allies and the United States itself, the president himself, worried about the effect on his political authority in the United States. Now, all I'm going to say about all of this, very briefly, before I move on, is that, of course, the president has brought all of these problems on himself. There was no pressing reason to attack Iran at this time. Iran is not attacking any other country, certainly not at this time. Arguably, it has only acted in military terms when it has been attacked itself. The Iranians have repeatedly made offers to negotiate about their nuclear program and their nuclear enrichment program. There was the JCPOA agreed in 2015, which the president himself, during his first term, very unwisely, in my opinion, walked out of. And of course, we've had a cascade of proposals made both by the Iranians and by various Arab states, and by the way, by the Russians, all of which taken together would find ways of addressing the issue of non-proliferation in relation to Iran's nuclear program, an issue which, of course, the Iranians themselves insist does not exist because they have no plans to develop nuclear weapons. So the president moved forward with his whole operation when there was absolutely no need to. And if he finds himself in a difficult position now, when he's got vast forces deployed against Iran, but that the political risks are increasing and the pressure on him from every side is growing, well, he has no one in the end to blame but himself. I accept that he comes under immense pressure from people like Netanyahu and other people, his donors in Washington and people like that. But he is the president of the United States, and as a former president once said, the buck stops with him. He could have said no to all of these people. Instead, he said yes. And, well, he is where he now is with all of the enormous risks piling up around him. I have to say that this, with this particular president, I remain of the view that if there is not going to be an attack now, over the next few days, then at some point the attack will come. In the meantime, the US military are being stretched almost to breaking point. I understand that there are three US carriers currently engaging in operations. One is the Abraham Lincoln, which is in the Arabian Sea. The other is the Gerald Ford. And that there is a third carrier in East Asia somewhere. I am not sure where. All of the other carriers apparently are undergoing maintenance, and their crews have already been under considerable stress because of earlier deployments, and some of the carriers are in urgent need of repair because of wear and tear. What a prolonged deployment around Iran is going to do is it's going to aggravate that problem. And I believe the same applies to the stealth fighter jets, which have now been deployed to the Gulf in profuse numbers. They too will soon start to suffer from significant maintenance issues. I understand it comes with the type of fighter jet we're talking about. Stealth fighters are very, very maintenance heavy. And of course, it's not just that the president may not have thought through properly the risks in terms of attacking Iran, but he doesn't seem to have understood that one of his key allies, Britain, is also going through a major political crisis, and that a prime minister like Keir Starmer is going to have concerns, doubts about allowing the United States to use the island of Diego Garcia, where there is a major American base, for the operation against Iran, notwithstanding that this is the current battle plan. For the moment, it seems, Starmer is refusing to allow Diego Garcia to be used in this way, which has provoked angry comments from Trump and complaints about Starmer's plan to transfer the Chagos Islands, of which Diego Garcia is one, to Mauritius. I would say in advance, by the way, that anybody who thinks that Starmer is going to stick to that position, or that the British government is going to stick to this position, well, I have a bridge to sell them in that case. If the final decision to attack Iran is ever made, or perhaps I should correct that, when the final decision to attack Iran is finally made, I fully expect the British to permit the use of Diego Garcia for the operation. But anyway, this is all I'm going to say about this issue at the moment. I've discussed the whole crisis around Iran extensively in recent programmes, and I don't want to spend more time at the moment. But it does look as if possibly, just possibly, because of the doubts and nervousness and fear growing in Washington, we might have a little more time, perhaps days, more likely weeks. Mid-March now looks like it's a significant danger period. I don't think myself that the US can keep its military forces up to this level of strength around Iran for long beyond that point. So mid-March perhaps is the danger time. But as I said, in some ways, for the president, the risks constantly grow. Iran will probably use the next few weeks to strengthen itself even further. It will get more help from its Chinese and Russian friends. And if things go wrong, as I said, the president will almost certainly face the further humiliation of having to cancel a trip to Beijing, which he also was the one who insisted upon. Now, if that is not bad enough for the president, and probably another cause of his stress, we had yesterday a decision from the Supreme Court of the United States declaring his tariffs unconstitutional. Now, here I should say that this decision fully vindicates analysis that I received and we on the Duran have received from our friend, the US Attorney Robert Barnes. He has said increasingly that it looked like the Supreme Court was going to rule against the president on this issue. And, well, he's right. Now, it was a 6-3 decision. And let me stress, I am not an American constitutional lawyer, but I've always wondered how this issue could be up for discussion or doubt at all, given that the Constitution clearly says that Congress is the only party that has the right to legislate on taxation. And the tariffs ultimately are taxes. But I do accept that there are all kinds of contrary arguments and legal arguments, and three judges apparently decided in a different way and said that the president could do that which he wished. Now, the president is busy at the moment complaining about the Supreme Court decision, imposing his tariffs, trying to reimpose his tariffs in other ways using different legislation. I'm not going to discuss in this program how legally valid that approach is. The latest device he's used, a 10% flat tariff, well, that can apparently only last for 150 days. And I think it is very likely that before long, he's going to try to find other means to impose tariffs further. For the record, and just to set out my own opinion, I think the president undermined his entire case, both economic and legal, by his practice of imposing retaliatory tariffs on countries that he alleged had engaged in unfair trade practices against the United States. He seemed entirely unaware that the apostles of protectionism in the United States in the 19th and early 20th century had consistently argued against retaliatory tariffs as fundamentally inimical to the whole idea of protectionism. And, well, he went further still, in my opinion, by conflating tariffs with sanctions, using tariffs as a mechanism for bullying and economic coercion and pressure, as we have recently seen with India, for example. I think that almost certainly doing all of those things will have undermined his case in the Supreme Court of the United States. There is no sign that the president has learnt anything from this. He's just extremely angry with the decision. But I'm going to suggest that one thing people should be prepared for is that this particular president, obsessed as he is with tariffs and focused on tariffs, to the exclusion of pretty much everything else in terms of economic policy, is now very likely to look with much greater sympathy to the Lindsey Graham, Richard Blumenthal bill to impose massive sanctions against any country that buys Russian oil. Because if this bill passes Congress and is signed into law, it gives Trump a legal vehicle to impose tariffs, pretty much, I would have thought, on anyone he chooses, because Russian oil is internationally traded and can be found pretty much everywhere in the world in some form or other. And Trump can use that to impose his tariff regime and say that in doing what he has done, he has the authority of Congress. I think that this thought has undoubtedly occurred to him and to his lawyers and other advisers. And despite the various attempts or the talk we have heard about trying to improve relations with Russia, about cutting huge economic deals with Russia, about putting pressure on Ukraine, tariffs obviously are more important to Trump than any one of those things. I suspect that in fact and in practice, Trump will be very, very tempted to go down this disastrous road and go down the way of backing or reviving the Graham Blumenthal bill in order to give himself authority to impose tariffs. So I think we should all be prepared for that. Now, I said that this affair has, this decision in the Supreme Court of the United States has vindicated the advice and legal analysis of Robert Barnes. I should say that the recent economic numbers from the United States, the trade figures from the United States, have vindicated someone else, and that someone else is Professor Jeffrey Sachs. Professor Sachs has consistently argued, he did so in one of the programs we did on the Duran, that Trump's idea that imposing tariffs was going to end the American deficit in goods was simply wrong. The reason the United States imports goods is because its demand for goods is greater than the number of goods it produces. And this is, to a great extent, also a factor of runaway spending of a budget in the United States, which is in effect out of control, with the United States now running an ever bigger budget deficit. It was inevitable, even with the tariffs, that the United States would run a trade deficit, specifically a deficit in goods. And the recent economic numbers, the trade numbers, have confirmed this completely. It is astonishing how little difference the tariffs have actually made to the trade dynamics in the United States. There's been really no sign that the tariffs have reduced the trade deficit, and there's little sign that they have encouraged reindustrialization in the United States. I correct that. There is no sign at all that they have helped with reindustrialization in the United States. On the contrary, the process of deindustrialization there continues. As I have myself said, I am personally, not being an economist, relatively neutral on this issue, about which I do not have great expertise. But I am open to the idea that, as in the 19th century, protectionism can sometimes have its uses. But it is not the only tool. If you want reindustrialization in the United States, you need to develop a proper plan on how to achieve it. And as of now, there is none. And one of the ways to achieve it is through cutting the American budget deficit. And the best way to achieve that, by the way, is probably by cutting defense spending, most of which produces very little in terms of actual usable weapons. Anyway, to cut the budget deficit which of course Trump not only is not doing, he's taking every step to increase it. Anyway, this is what I'm going to say about these two topics. Let's now turn to the conflict in Ukraine. And we are, it seems to me, still in the aftermath of the Geneva talks. The talks which the Ukrainians went into, perhaps with some expectation of flexibility on the Russian side. I have a suspicion that the fact that Kostyakov and Budanov apparently got on reasonably well at the Abu Dhabi talks, and that there was some movement on some of the military and security issues, that that might have led the Ukrainians into thinking, and the Americans led the Americans into thinking, that the Russians might be more flexible than they really are. And Medinsky's arrival in Geneva put paid to all of that, and it appears to have come as a total shock. Now, at this point, I'm going to just remind everyone that a few weeks ago, I said that after the attack on Valdai, I got the sense from things that Putin and his aide, Yuri Ushakov, was saying, that the Russians were preparing to harden their position in the talks, both with the Americans and obviously with the Ukrainians. This was controversial. I personally still think it is the case, but I accept that there were arguments that might have pointed in a different way. Could it be that one of the reasons that Medinsky's intervention in Geneva came as such a shock is because Medinsky came to the meeting telling the Ukrainians and the Americans that whatever it was that Putin and Trump supposedly agreed in Anchorage, the so-called Anchorage formula, didn't apply anymore because the Americans had failed to act on it and because the Europeans had undermined it. Well, I wasn't in the room, I don't know, but it's obvious from the Ukrainian reaction that they were very unhappy indeed, shocked by the stance in Geneva which Medinsky took. Now, yesterday, Medinsky and Kostyakov met Putin, and not just Putin, but the entire Russian Security Council. So Medvedev, Shoigu, Belousov, Lavrov are all there in the room as Medinsky and Kostyakov provided their report on what happened in Geneva. And they would have, over the course of the same meeting, received instructions. Now, this is interesting and it is important, and it may bring us back to some of the points I've been making in the past, which is that it did seem to me last autumn that Putin's continued insistence, his decision to stick with what he and Trump had agreed in Geneva, despite American backtracking, despite the sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, and despite the talk about the United States supplying Ukraine with Tomahawk missiles, it did seem to me that this was causing dissension in Moscow, including at elite level, with some people in Moscow saying that Putin was taking an insufficiently firm line. And I've also pointed out that over the course of last year, the second part of last year, Putin had certain relatively uncomfortable meetings with the Russian media. He met with journalists on several occasions. He was asked pointed questions about the dialogue with the Americans and with Trump. And on at least two occasions, journalists brought up the vexed issue of Ukraine joining the EU, with the journalists straightforwardly asking, why does Russia still not object to Ukraine joining the EU, given that the EU is itself militarizing and is changing its character from being an economic organization to becoming a military one, and is compulsively, obsessively, hysterically hostile to Russia as well. And I got the impression that Putin, from his eva I got the impression from Putin's evasive answers that he was embarrassed by the questions and he didn't have a real response to them. So I said that I thought that it was likely that some kind of debate in Russia was underway, which might produce a harder line. And well, we've seen what happened with Medinsky in Geneva, but might it not be consistent, at least to some extent, with this analysis that Medinsky, in reporting the outcome of the meeting in Geneva, instead of reporting just to Putin, who could then have gone and reported to the Security Council based on what Medinsky and Kostyakov had told him, that instead Medinsky and Kostyakov were attending the entire Security Council, where all of the participants, all of the members of the Security Council, Lavrov, Shoigu, Belousov, Medvedev, the intelligence chiefs, everyone would have been in a position to listen to them, to listen to their report, and presumably to ask them questions. So it looks to me as if, at least at the moment, there is a more collective approach in Moscow to decisions about the Ukraine war and about the negotiations themselves. To repeat again, this should not be taken to mean that there is any challenge or threat to Putin's position. Rather, it is part of a decision apparently taken at some point in the second half of last year that members of the Security Council should be more actively consulted and informed about what was going on and should be in a position to participate in making the decisions. Anyway, there it was, Medinsky and Kostyakov there, and Medinsky and Kostyakov no doubt providing their report and receiving, as I said, their instructions, not just from Putin, but from the Security Council as a whole. I say instructions because apparently the plan is to have the next follow-up meeting fairly soon, though we now come to the Ukrainians, and I wonder whether they will be happy to go. Because we've had more extraordinary comments and decisions from Zelensky. Now, Zelensky apparently called all the ministers together in Kiev and dropped them a bombshell. He said that Ukraine is not losing the war. In fact, it's actually winning the war. And not only is Ukraine not losing the war, but it must fight on. He is not happy at all with the way Donald Trump has handled the diplomacy up to now. He's obviously even less happy with the Russians, who continue to hold toughly to their negotiating position. And what Zelensky says is that Ukraine must prepare, should prepare, for a long war, a war lasting at least another 3 years. 3 years is, of course, would of course bring us to the next presidential elections in the United States, to the end of Donald Trump's term. Zelensky presumably hoping, expecting, gambling that the new president, the next president of the United States, will be friendlier and more supportive of Ukraine than the current president, Donald Trump, has turned out to be. That the golden era, as it must seem to him, of Joe Biden, where the Americans gave Zelensky and the Ukrainians whatever they asked for, would return. Anyway, there's been reports about this meeting, both in the US media and in Strana, the Ukrainian news site, published actually outside Ukraine. Very interesting and very fine news site altogether, in my opinion. Anyway, they still have good information coming from Ukraine, and they've given us a good idea of the mood of this meeting, because the ministers apparently heard, listened to Zelensky in shocked amazement. The idea of Ukraine fighting on for another 3 years appears to have horrified them. Apparently, they were quietly working away to try to get elections organised as soon as May, and perhaps a referendum as well. Things which Zelensky has repeatedly spoken out against, by the way. There were reports about a week ago that the Ukrainians were thinking about holding elections and a referendum fairly soon. Then Zelensky came out and he said that he knew absolutely nothing about it. He had no such plan. He had no such intentions. But it looks from the Strana report especially that some ministers simply paid no attention and continued to work on the basis that there would be a referendum, putting some kind of negotiated deal on the table, presenting it to the Ukrainian people, and elections as well. And now they have been told to forget all about that, that instead Ukraine must continue fighting for 3 more years, a program of unlimited, endless war, and that that is the only way, supposedly, that Ukraine can achieve a fair and just peace. And this is Zelensky's mantra. Ukraine is not losing. It must be prepared to fight on for 3 more years. And of course, in the Western media, in the British media, Zelensky's loyal chorus are now also parroting the same line. Ukraine isn't really losing at all. Russian gains have been insignificant. Since 2022, the Russians have only captured 13% of Ukraine, and they are advancing at the rate of a snail. Their losses are enormous. If Ukraine is under any sort of pressure, if it is having any real difficulties, this is entirely because of Donald Trump. My old friend, Simon Tisdall, goes further still. He says it's not just Donald Trump who's to blame for the fact that Ukraine's position is not even better. It is America's it's America that's at fault. It's America, it's Obama for not giving more unstinting support to Ukraine. It's Trump's during his first term. It's Joe Biden for not imposing a no-fly zone over Ukraine and deploying the US Air Force to take on the Russians and accepting all the risks of nuclear war and all of that. America has failed Ukraine, because if the West gave Ukraine the unstinting, unqualified, unconditional, limitless support that it supposedly deserves, why, victory would obviously and absolutely be there. Now, I have to say that I find all of this incredible. Every year, at the end of every year, since 2023 especially, when the Ukrainian offensive failed, at the end of 2024 and at the end of 2025, I said to myself that given the obvious massive deterioration in Ukraine's position that took place over the course of that year, surely these people would finally change their tune and recognize what a disaster for Ukraine this war is turning out to be. Even if they do indeed just stick to their favoured metric, which is territory captured, the Russians are capturing a lot of territory. They're capturing many cities since the end of Ukraine's 2023 counteroffensive: Toretsk, Chasiv Yar, Avdeyevka, Selidovo, Kurakhovo, Pokrovsk, Ugledar, Siversk, Mirnograd, Guliapolye. They will be captured. Now, maybe these are not famous cities in the West, but then how many people in the West before the war could have named any towns and cities in Donbass at all? Just saying. What about the Kursk operation that also took place, or rather ended last year? Ended in complete disaster. Well, that, of course, nobody ever talks about anymore. It's vanished down a memory hole. It is the defeat that must never be mentioned, even though it was a total disaster for Ukraine. But nonetheless, you know, when Zelensky says that all is well, everything is going to plan, Ukraine is winning, Russia is losing, we are suffering insignificant casualties, the Russians are suffering enormous casualties. Well, sooner or later, that mantra, that absurd mantra, repeats itself, leaving, by the way, many Ukrainians, such as, for example, the good people at Strana, people like Zelensky's press officer, Yulia Mendel, and one suspects in the dark watches of the night, Kirill Budanov as well. Anyway, all of this leaves all of these people, I suspect, well, not I suspect, definitely, in despair. Certainly, the ministers of Zelensky's government must feel this. They must feel that this demand, that this nightmare be prolonged for a further 3 years, well, it was horrifying. And apparently, Zelensky was listened to in a kind of shocked silence. Well, there it is. I've never myself believed that Zelensky is ever going to change his stance, even or rather when all of Donbass falls under Russian control. If it is left up to him, the war will continue. I read about 2 weeks ago a fine piece in the American Conservative, which said that Zelensky knows perfectly well that if he agrees, he were to agree to peace, a peace which would have to be now on Russian terms. It would be the end of his political career, and it would also perhaps open him up not just to criticism, but to threats which he obviously does not want to face. And he also, I suspect, and I've no doubt about this, calculates that keeping the war going keeps everybody, his supporters, by which I mean the elite group in Kiev, who ultimately look to him, it keeps them fed, if you like, glutted with the unending flow of money and other things that come from the West. I don't believe that Zelensky will ever change his stance. The person who wrote that piece in the American Conservative seemed to think the same. And I think that anyone who wants to follow what is happening in the war needs to recognise that fact. But anyway, that currently is the plan. And given that this is the plan, why exactly would Zelensky want to send a delegation to meet with the Russians, with Medinsky again, by the way, at any point over the next couple of days or weeks? Probably, if it were left to him, he would not. He also knows that the Europeans continue to be behind him. Apparently, it actually was the case that they really did try to gatecrash the meeting in Geneva on the second day. But for once, the Russians and the Americans combined and said no. Well, anyway, there it is. The Europeans continue to back Zelensky. Zelensky remains as hardline as ever. He has, in the SBU, now loyally controlled by his sinister henchman, General Poklad, an organization big enough and powerful enough and ruthless enough to stamp on all opposition. And, well, it seems to me that the war will go on. Now, on the topic of the war, I was reading a fascinating piece by the British commentator Warwick Powell, which you can find on his Substack blog, his Substack site. And Warwick Powell uses mathematical methodology applied to attrition war, which was developed following, in the early part of the 20th century, based on data from that most famous of all attrition wars, the First World War. And without going into details, you can read it all on Warwick Powell's Substack site. Warwick Powell's assessment is that Ukraine is now at the tipping point, that the Ukrainian army is now depleting faster and faster, that it is unable to replace losses, and that by around July, perhaps September of this year, we will move from a position of gradual decay towards some sort of collapse, that the Ukrainians after this period will no longer be able to contain advances on the front lines, Russian advances on the front lines. The Russians, unlike the Ukrainians, are able fully to replace all their losses, and they have a massive technical advantage. They have more tanks, armoured vehicles, artillery, shells, drones, all of those things than the Ukrainians can possibly hope to have. And after, well, shall we say, late summer of this year, this crisis will develop opening the way for far much faster territorial advances by the Russians all the way to Odessa, if that is indeed the Russian objective, which, by the way, I have no doubt that it is. Now, I have to say that all of this has been said before, but Warwick Powell assesses the situation, I think, very objectively and based on information drawn from open sources, not just Russian open sources, but Western and Ukrainian ones as well. And I personally have great difficulty arguing with what he is saying. Perhaps he overstates the problems somewhat, but I'm guessing by not that much. He does say that there are variables. The Western powers might ramp up support for Ukraine. That looks very unlikely. The Western powers might decide to directly intervene in the war. That is perhaps just conceivable, but unlikely as well. But on the existing trends, the outcome is sure. Now, here I'm going to make a number of points. Firstly, it's not often realised that the Russians not only chose to fight this as an attrition war, but they actually said so. The person who announced the strategy was none other than the General Suravikin, who was the Russian commander-in-chief of the Russian forces participating in the special military operation for a certain period in the last few months of 2022. And Suravikin said that he would not aim for breakthroughs. He would not seek quick victories. He would build strong positions. He would build up reserves, and he would grind the Ukrainians down. And these comments, made in an interview on Russian television, became very quickly famous in Russia and have been the policy ever since. Gerasimov, who may have had differences with Suravikin on some issues, undoubtedly shares the same perspective. And I can say that again with confidence, because the Russians have themselves, in several commentaries, I mean Russian military officers, have spoken about the policy of attrition. I remember Shoigu, who was, when he was still defense minister, in early 2024, after the fall of Avdeyevka, also talking about attrition. And it was around that time that I coined the expression aggressive attrition to describe what the Russians were doing. And for a certain time, that phrase, I noticed with some amusement, gained wide coinage, including, by the way, in Russia itself. Just saying. Anyway, the point is that the Russians are very accustomed to waging attrition war. It's very much part of their way of doing war. And one of the reasons, I think, is because they do approach war in mathematical terms. They do like to calculate and assess things mathematically. Russia has always had a bias to rely on mathematics in its planning. And the kind of analysis that Warwick Powell has done, I suspect, very, very closely matches the kind of mathematical analysis on attrition issues that has been carried out within the Russian General Staff, probably since roughly 2022, that they have been putting inputs into their models, and they themselves are calculating when the breakdown moment will come. And provided the data is accurate within a reasonable range, I suspect that the Russians think that they can pick the moment when they can start to move with fairly high accuracy. So just saying. Now, the other thing that's interesting about Warwick Powell's assessment is that, of course, it very, very closely matches the comments which I discussed yesterday, made by the operations chief of the Russian General Staff, Colonel General Sergei Rudskoy. Rudskoy is Russia's main military planner. Though Gerasimov is the man in overall charge, Rudskoy is his number two, and it is Rudskoy who does all this planning. He is the person who probably draws up the plans, and he's probably the person who does, who feeds all of this data into the computers in Moscow, and who comes up with these results and with these numbers. And Rudskoy said yesterday that the Ukrainian army is indeed depleting, that it suffered its heaviest ever losses in 2025, that it is withering away, and that the Russians have the initiative on every part of the contact line. So again, if you go to Warwick Powell's analysis, it's probably not that different from the kind of analysis that is taking place in Moscow. Though, of course, the Russians will do this on a vastly greater and more elaborated scale than Warwick Powell, a single individual with a laptop, can ever hope to do. Just say. Now, let's turn to the situation on the front lines, because we're now getting actually significant information. One of the very frustrating myths has been that this has been an idle winter, that advances have supposedly slowed to a stop, that the Russians have been treading water, if I can put it like that, through this winter, and that we need to wait until the spring, summer before something happens. The same claims were made during the winter last year. They were not true then, and they are even less true today. Russian advances have been faster this winter than they were last winter, and the advances last winter were faster than the advances the winter before. But we're now increasingly seeing increasing movement. Now let's begin in Zaporozhye region. There's been a lot of discussion, there still is a lot of discussion, about the Ukrainian counterattack in Zaporozhye region. As I discussed again in my program yesterday, Julian Röpke of Bild Zeitung considers this whole story nonsense, that there's no truth to it. In fact, what we now learn is that it is the Russian army that is advancing in Zaporozhye region from the east towards the west, in precisely the areas where the Ukrainians have been conducting their supposed offensive. We can see now clear evidence of Russian advances. And it looks as if the Russians are now working towards capturing a string of towns which lie to the west of the Gaichur River and to the west of Guliapolye, and by the way, Ternovata, which they also now control. From north to south, these are Rizvyanka, Vozvizhivka, Verkhnaya, Tersa, and Guliapilska. Now, this is the next Ukrainian defense line, if you will. And this isn't so much a defence line, it's more a string of villages. Apparently there are few actual fortifications there. But once these places are captured, the way is open. There is no barriers, physical barriers at all, before the Russians reach the main road leading to Orekhov from the north. And I believe this is the main supply road to Orekhov. There are two supply roads to Orekhov. One is from Zaporozhye City in the further west. The other is this road that the Russians would reach once they've captured this string of villages. Now, General Teplinsky's group of forces, Dnieper, is already very close to the road from Zaporozhye to Orekhov. If the Russians capture these villages, the other road to Orekhov, the other supply road to Orekhov, will be within their sights. Both roads will be closed, and the supplies to Orekhov will cease. The Russians would also be positioned well to the north and west and south of Orekhov. In fact, Orekhov would be very quickly surrounded. Now, logically, the Ukrainians should withdraw in that case from Orekhov. More likely, especially given his present mood, Zelensky's going to insist that they stay where they are. General Sirsky will no doubt do the same, and also insist that the Ukrainian defenders defend Orekhov to the last man. We will, in other words, have another cauldron, another disaster, but the outcome is inevitable. One way or the other, Orekhov will fall. And then there is nothing left before Zaporozhye City itself and the Dnieper. And the Dnieper lies between Zaporozhye City and western Ukraine. Zaporozhye City is on the east bank. And for that reason, most commentators who know about these things say that it is undefendable. One of the most important industrial cities of Ukraine, the key, if you like, to the Dnieper in its central regions, the area which Ukraine cannot afford to lose if it is to retain functional viability as a state, at least a state within its former borders. If Zaporozhye City is lost, economically, politically, it really would be the beginning of the end. Just saying. So we can see the crisis that is developing there. But we also have the other crisis, which is now rapidly developing in Donbass. And, well, again, this is a topic of, shall we say, controversy. Many people still insist that the situation for the Russians in Donbass is not good, that they are not making specific progress or anything of that kind. Well, I have to say, I simply do not agree. Yesterday, an article appeared in Radovka. This is the newspaper based in Smolensk, which is nationalist, but very well informed about the situation, the military situation. And a reporter who I believe actually works for Radovka actually provided his own assessment of the situation for Radovka. He said that Russian armed forces are approaching, this is the title in Radovka, are approaching the final stage of liberating Slavyansk and Kramatorsk. To achieve success, they need to capture an important height. This is Mount Karachun, which is located between Slovyansk and Kramatorsk. And the journalist, whose name, by the way, is Stanislav Obishenko, then explained that capturing this height will provide Russian units with a significant tactical advantage. And before this happens, there will be a large-scale encirclement, and this will require the liberation of several other towns, including Dobropilia, which is located to the west and which the Russians are now approaching, and Alexandrivka, which is located to the east and which the Russians are approaching, by the way, as well. And then Obishenko went on to say that the scale of the upcoming operation will be enormous. It will result in the largest cauldron in the history of modern military operations. And he said that it would be comparable to some of the grand encirclement operations that took place during the Second World War. So anyway, that is what he says. And again, one must resist, perhaps, confirmation bias. But it accords with my own understanding of the way things are moving on the battlefronts. With Zelensky rejecting all suggestions of withdrawal, we could very well find, perhaps in midsummer, a situation where Slavyansk and Kramatorsk have both been encircled, and where Orekhov is also encircled, and perhaps where the Russians have in effect encircled Zaporozhye as well, the city of Zaporozhye as well, or if not encircled it, placed it under close siege. If all of that happens over the course of this year, it will break Ukraine. And in fact, we are getting reports today of further Russian advances in the area of Donbass, of Dobropilia now being well within Russian sights, of the Russians having now cleared Gryshino. We still have to wait for an announcement to this effect from the Russian Defense Ministry. And of the Russians pushing westwards from Siversk. And interestingly, they are not just approaching Slavyansk, but some of their latest advances, particularly the advance towards Alexandrivka, actually brings the Russians closer to Kramatorsk and closer to capturing this hill that Obishenko is talking about. Anyway, that's what I'm going to say about the military situation. There were more drone attacks and missile strikes by each side against the other last night. The major Russian target was Odessa. The Ukrainians launched more of their big, cumbersome Flamingo missiles, which even Zelensky admits Ukraine possesses in very limited numbers. And the Russians claim to have shot five of these big cumbersome missiles down. Maybe one got through. Maybe it did do some damage. But an economy Russia's side can certainly absorb all of this. Anyway, that seems to me to give an overall view of the military situation and the diplomatic situation in Ukraine. Unless there is a diplomatic breakthrough over the next few months, I can't really imagine that the situation will not get much, much worse. And, well, at some point, presumably, all of these people in the West who continue to insist that all is well, that Ukraine is fighting successfully, that all it needs is a little bit more time and help and support, in fact, a lot more time and help and support, that the wicked Putin and his Russian hordes can still be defeated. Well, at that point, I presume that even they finally will have to face the realities. Though I've no doubt that when that does happen, what they're going to do is to blame everybody but themselves. Anyway, we are in that point. If Donbass falls, if Zaporozhye falls, there will be no doubt any longer, in my opinion, that in military terms and economic terms too, we are in the end game in Ukraine. Ukraine would not be able to sustain the war for much longer, certainly not in the kind of condition that it is in, regardless of what further Western aid it was provided. Now, in the meantime, we continue to get intrigues. Another German media outlet, Der Spiegel, is now saying that the Americans were informed by the Ukrainians, by Zelensky, that Ukraine intended to blow up the Nord Stream pipelines in 2022. This is supposedly told by the Ukrainians to the CIA, and the CIA said, great, wonderful idea. But then the Americans supposedly changed their mind and said, well, actually, we don't think it's such a good idea after all. Not really explained very clearly why the Americans are supposed to have changed their minds. I don't take seriously any part of this story, just say. But it does provide the first concrete admission in a German media outlet that the Americans had some involvement in the attack on the Nord Stream pipelines, even if they weren't supposedly involved in the attack itself. So that is interesting, and it does beg questions. It does beg questions about why some people in Germany are prepared to provide this information, given that up to now, any suggestion of direct American involvement has received heated denials. But anyway, we shall see. In the meantime, I mentioned that people in the West are in total denial about the realities. I was reading in The Guardian yesterday an astonishing article by its long-standing correspondent, Sean Walker, about the origins of the war, the events that led up to the war in February 2022. And I have to say, this account left me gasping. Firstly, Sean Walker's explanation for the Russian attack is that during the pandemic, Vladimir Putin spent an awful lot of time reading books. That caused him apparently to decide that the time had come to establish himself as this great conqueror by conquering Ukraine. I mean, that is the only explanation for Putin's actions that Sean Walker is willing to come up with. The article, and I did find this incredible, makes no reference to the Maidan coup or seizure of power of 2014 and of the Russian reaction to it. It never mentions the Minsk agreement at any point. It never mentions the negotiations between the Russians and the Americans in December and January 2021 and 2022 over in relation to the two draft treaties. The word NATO never appears, as far as I can see, in any part of this article. It refers to a meeting of the Russian Security Council that took place 4 years ago, literally to the day, on the 21st of February 2022. This was a meeting where Putin and the members of the Russian Security Council discussed whether Russia should recognize the independence of Lugansk and Donetsk, the two Donbass republics. It doesn't mention that the main topic of discussion at this meeting was Ukraine's failure to act to fulfill its obligations under the Minsk Agreement, or that the Security Council also discussed fighting that was already ongoing in Donbass. The Organization for Security Cooperation in Europe has actually confirmed that there was a major uptick in shelling in Donbass over the previous weeks. And of course, you can argue who was responsible, though the OSCE seemed to suggest that it was mostly the Ukrainians. But you can argue if you wish, I don't agree, but that it was the Russians looking to provide for themselves a pretext. But surely, surely in any discussion about the war, you need to talk about it. And the article says that at this meeting of the Russian Security Council on the 21st of February 2022, Putin came up against unexpected opposition from a hardliner, former hardliner, Dmitry Kozak, his former deputy chief of staff. And Kozak supposedly spoke out against a Russian military intervention in Ukraine, saying that it would be a disaster. Well, you can find the entire transcript of the meeting of the Security Council, the Russian Security Council, on the Kremlin's website. And there's a film also somewhere, but I remember that meeting very, very well. I checked what Kozak actually said, and he said nothing of the kind. What he said was, as Russia's representative in the negotiations with Ukraine to fulfill the terms of the Minsk Agreement, that the Ukrainians were never going to fulfill the Minsk Agreement. He spoke scathingly about the Ukrainians. He said that their behaviour was cretinous, moronic, and he used at times even stronger language. And he said that the Ukrainians had no desire to bring Donbass back into Ukraine on any sort of terms, which, as far as I can see, was an argument for their recognition. Just saying, the whole Kozak story about him acting as some kind of critic of the war is absurd, and it contradicts earlier reports that on the first day of the special military operation, on the 24th of February 2022, 3 days after this Security Council meeting, Kozak allegedly telephoned the Ukrainians, spoke on the phone to Yermak, and said to the Ukrainians, look, all you have to do is pull your forces out of Donbass, in which case there will be no fighting between us at all. So, anyway, I am at a loss to understand how a story, an article like this could be written. There was one very interesting revelation in it, though it is a purely historic one, and that is that Sean Walker rather grudgingly admits that in the weeks and months reading up to the start of the special military operation, despite extraordinary rhetoric, as I remember from the West, that the Russians were about to invade, and lots of reports and claims that the Western powers, the United States and Britain, did have evidence that Russia was about to invade. It turns out that, in fact, they had no intelligence, no actual information that the Russians had any plan or intention to invade or attack or occupy any part of Ukraine whatsoever. It was pure rhetoric at the time. It was not based on any actual knowledge. And as to what did eventually cause the Russians to intervene, well, it seems to me that Sean Walker's article basically doesn't tell us, because, as I said, it involves all of these salient facts. Now, one hears lots of words thrown around, propaganda, disinformation, that sort of thing. Some of those words are used rather openly by journalists in some media outlets, like some of the ones that Sean Walker has written for. I think that those who make those claims ought to remember that those who live inside a glass house should not throw stones. Anyway, that's all I'm going to say on this programme. This is me for today. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble and X, and as well as Substack as well. Links under this video. Please remember, if you've liked this video, to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. And please also remember that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop. Links under this video also. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.